is side one of a conversation with Mr. James Mitchell and Mr. James Morris in Des Moines, Iowa on February the 20th, 1975.
Participating are Mrs. Elaine Estes and James Hatch.
I guess Mr. Mitchell will begin with you. When and where were you born?
Well, they tell me that I was born in a little town of Harrison, Georgia. That's all I know about it. Of course, that the old family Bible gave that information to us.
And you moved from there?
Well, my father was a Methodist preacher, and we traveled all over as a child, all over Southwest Georgia, from town to town, and he had a charge.
What year were you born?
Well, I'm going to tell you what the Army says.
1892. Mm-hmm. And in those years of traveling with your father, that was mostly in the South?
All in the South.
All in the South.
You don't mean that.
My father, he said.
What were then you kind of, what kind of schooling did you get? Kind of in and out?
Well, I was at Morris Brown College when we were called in the service.
Mm-hmm. But I'm talking now about your younger years. You moved every couple of
years. Yes, yes, we had to. It was kind of smattering. My father pastored what they call a circuit at the little town of Georgetown, Georgia. I crossed the river into Eufaula, Alabama on bicycle, about 3 miles away, every morning to school. When he was moved from there, I think we went to Shelman, Georgia. And then from there to America, then all over, just I could get his name. So many of them.
Mm-hmm. He was not what was called a circuit rider in D.C.
No, well, you see, at the time, you couldn't find very many churches down there who could support a minister. So they'd give him three churches, small churches, and he would spend one Sunday at each church. See? Mm-hmm. And salary wasn't the thing. They didn't know what the word salary meant. And then you bring you some chickens and bring you some feed for your horse and maybe a few eggs. And on Thanksgiving, maybe a turkey. And just that kind of thing. That's where the people paid their church dues, mostly.
I understand it was that way here in Iowa, too, at one time.
Did the church provide a place of residence for the minister? Or
yes, they did have some kind of a little shack called a parsonage. Now, once in a while, we'd strike it pretty good.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
I had five sisters.
And you say you went to Morris College?
Morris Brown. Morris in Atlanta.
How did you went there to train as a minister?
No, I'll tell you a little story about that. I came home from school when I was a little chap, 8 years old, and my father was away on some kind of church service, and there was no food in the house. And my dad, with old Bishop Turner, you know, I used to sit on Bishop Turner's knee when I was a child. And he was grooming me for the ministry. And at that tender age, I decided if being a minister was going to make me hungry, I'll never be a preacher.
I think it would be interesting to incorporate your mother and father's name.
He was, when he passed, he was presiding elder of the Macon District, Macon, Georgia District.
What was his full name?
James W. Mitchell. Some say William Mitchell and some say Wardlow Mitchell. Now I think William was. Yeah, James William Mitchell, that was his name.
But your name is Wardlow.
Yeah.
Well, Morris Brown is an undergraduate school in Atlanta, which was supported by the A.M.E. Church. At one time, there were about half a dozen of those schools. Atlanta University, Atlanta Baptist College, Clark University, Morris Brown College, there were four of them. and then Spelman Seminary, a girls' school, which was Bill Lee Roosevelt, Lee Rockefeller. That's what makes me always think to go to the Rockefeller, that she was the one who stopped, put the money to stop that school. Yeah.
Just what was your mother's name?
Cecilia.
Maiden name?
No, Cecilia Haskett.
Uh-huh.
Cecilia Haskett. She was born in Vicksburg, Mississippi. And that's about as far as I know about her. I do know that her mother came and stayed with us while we were small children and on. And then my mother's sisters came by and picked her up and took her to California, and we lost track of them.
Were you required to do anything special to help your father in singing or anything of that sort?
No. I tell you, I left home when I was pretty young.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you, hunger will make you do a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
Really. So I was on the level. I went out and I'd sell newspapers as a kid. I'd pick wild berries and sell them right a bit. I even trapped quail and sold them so I could make some money. I picked up old whiskey and beer bottles and sold them 10 cents a dozen. I always had some kind of little money in my pocket. And then finally, when I was 14 years old, I ran away from home and I went to Tampa, Florida. I struck it rich down there.
What did you do in Tampa?
I went there. I was just about as tall as I am now, and a fellow told me that of a man who owned a small hotel there who might hire me. And I went to him, and he fired, as soon as he saw me, he fired a man right on the spot and took me. Well, I was down there. My mother and father didn't know where I was, and they were worried, my mother especially. And I had worked there, and people were just tipping me 25 cents and 50 cents, and I could run like a reindeer, and I was polite to them. And I saved up about $600. And I said, now I'm going back home. My father found out where I was, and he wrote me a letter asking me to come home, said if I cared for my mother's life and welfare, I'd come home immediately. So I did.
Now, the turn of the century, early part of the 20th century, was a time of very bad race relationships, as I read about it, you know, that the South was reconstructing its old patterns and making it very hard for black people. A lot of black people were moving north. Did you have any particular problems with
well,
folks down there in those days?
Not as a child, I didn't. Because I just had some kind of getting along sense with people. But after we were discharged there in Atlanta from Camp Gordon, I had some difficulty. Well, at the time, my mother and father were living at the old capital city of Millersville, Georgia. A sizable town, but I'd say like Ames. That's it. And I was still in uniform, and the state had a boys' military academy there in this town, and they had never seen a black officer. And I became a monstrosity. I walked up the streets of Millersville going to the post office, and people came to the door and crowded around me as though I was something from way out. And so I didn't know what they had in mind, because it was kind of a mean town. And I knew a fellow there who named Miller, who had a little drugstore, and I went in this drugstore, and he came from behind his little prescription counter to greet me, and I had my back to the door, and I heard some noise out there, and I turned and looked there, and there were maybe 300 or 400 people crowded around this drugstore. Well, I said, if I must go, I'll take some company with me. So I pulled my sidearm and faced them. And man, they found telephone poles and everything else to get by. Well, I was young and hot-headed. And so Miller asked me, say, please don't do that. Say, you ruin things. I said, I'm sorry. I said, but I don't intend to go alone. And so he rushed me out of the back door and took me over to my father's home. And the mayor of this town knew my father real well, and he came over there to say, Reverend, said, that boy of yours is kind of hot-headed. He said, the boy downtown is pretty mad about what he did. Said, but you keep him home, and said, I think I can quiet him down. And then at that point, I stepped out on the porch, and I said, Mr. Mayor, I says, I've faced death more than once, many times. And I says, I'm not afraid of it. I says, I'll come down to see of Millersville any damn time I please. And so my dad said, now son, you know I got to live here. And so that's an episode. And then I had one or two others, one in Atlanta. Called me a bad name. And motherhood about these. Of course, if I had had the sense that I have now, I wouldn't have done these things. And my mother asked me to please leave the South here because I know you're going to run into something here, and I don't want you murdered. And so here I am.
That's why you came.
Came back to the
Moines
to live.
Mm-hmm. All this happened around 1919, 1920. You're talking about now.
Yes, well, something happened in 1918. For instance, at the terminal station there in Nevada, my youngest sister was coming, we hadn't been discharged from the service, was coming to Atlanta to spend a day or two with me. And I don't know if you've ever been to Atlanta, you have to go down those tall steps to get to the trains. It comes in kind of underground. And so, I went there and to the train caller. He called this train coming in on track 17. I never will forget it. He said to me, I said to him, pardon me, please, but may I have a pass to get down to the train? But he was talking to another man. And I was polite, I thought. And he called me a black SOB and said, don't you see me talking to this gentleman? Well, he shouldn't have done that. Call me that name, because I put 150 pounds right in his full truck. And that's...
Excuse me, Jim, crack that door again.
Well, I could go on down the line. And
can you tell how you came to Des Moines and to get into the service? How did that happen?
Well, they, you know, Walter White and I guess it was Charlie Shaw, and I was standing in Five Points in Atlanta listening to Major General Leonard Wood, and his he's talking to 50,000 people out there in his Five Points, and I think it was Charlie Shaw and Walter White and I standing there, and he Major General Leonard Wood said, we are going across the water and we're going to lick the Hun, as he called. See, and when we come back, there'll be no black people. There'll be no brown people. There'll be no white people. Mm-hmm. We'll all be just people. And I hunched. Well, I said, man, did you hear what the man said? I said, let's go. And we rushed right on down to the Capitol and signed up for it. Then we took the physical and the mental and written examinations. And to qualify for that.
Mm. Is this the Walter White who was to be head of the NAACP?
Yes, he's the same one.
How did you happen to know him? What was your
I knew Walter, you know. Walter didn't get into the service. He signed up for it, but he didn't pass the exam.
And, you were in Morris Brown College at this time. Was he also enrolled at Morris Brown?
No, he graduated from Atlanta U. And, well, I have it. I lost my thought there.
Yeah, how you knew him, how you come to know
him. Oh, I knew him. I used to kind of go with one of his sisters, you know, Judy.
I want to apologize.
Did he, in those younger days, show the the kind of interest in the that he was going to do later? Yeah.
Very, very much so. He fights you. You know, some of the guys said, Walter, if I were just as white as you, I say I would hit a man in the mouth if he called me a Negro. and he's ready to fight when you said it, suggested that to him. And the whole family was mulattoes, you know. And everybody in the family could have passed for something other than black if they had wanted to. I knew the whole family real well.
Mm-hmm. He had a very strong sense of identification.
Yes. Yeah. But I think he lost some of that after he left it now.
What happened then? You went to sign up in Atlanta?
Well, we went and signed up at the state capitol, which was very close to the downtown area. And all we had to do was sign up and give our name and address and so forth as to our desire to go into the service, to join the officers' training camp out here. And then later on we were called in for these exams and physicals out at Fort Knight Person.
And there was no problem about your getting in, you just simply passed examination.
Passed examination, we were accepted. It's the only thing that made me so kind of bitter, but I've forgotten all of that now. We had a special course, I think there were 86 fellows from, mostly from Atlanta. And we had a special coach on the LNN coming out of Atlanta. And so we could go aboard anytime we wanted to, so we all came down early, and so the boys started to play bridge and playing little cards, you know, just having fun. And so they decided, they had told us that we wouldn't get breakfast until we got way up the road someplace. And so I wasn't playing cards with them, and they told me, elected me to go up to the Thompson restaurant. And there's something like $7 worth of sandwiches and pie and donuts and stuff. And I walked into this Thompson restaurant right up there on Peachtree Street. And so this guy, I gave him the order. And so when he put the package before me, the manager called him. And he came back and he did like this. I said, what's that? I don't understand deep and dumb language. He says, I mean, you have to pull off your hat when you come in here. I said, I don't see these other gentlemen's hats, so why do I have to pull mine off? Well, that's the rule. Wham! I just took the sandwich and I scattered them halfway down and walked out. And so I didn't know how I got away with that. I don't know. But I went on back down the coach and got on. Nothing was said or done. But when I went out the door, I passed along by that big plate glass window. I saw everybody in the restaurant was standing up looking at me.
At that time, there were northern recruiters coming down, people to recruit labor for the factories in the north. Did you ever see any of that business, of people leaving?
No, I didn't have any personal contact with them, but I've heard about it.
Yeah, well, he went to that in 1970. It began in 1918 when there was coming off to work in the steel mills and so forth. Mm-hmm. In 17, they had
this might be a good time to bring your life up to the same point of the World War and the enlistment. Where were you born and in what time?
Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, same.
1890.
You're just a year apart. And you grew up there?
I went to public schools. In Covington. I lived with my grandmother in a town called Covington, about 41 miles from Atlanta. And I lived with her until I came away. My mother's sister was a teacher at Clark University in Atlanta. I married a young man from Baltimore, down to Atlanta. That's one of them I didn't mention either. Mm-hmm. I was speaking about Atlanta. And when she married him, they went to Bedford, Virginia, their first charge. And she had my brother to come live with them. And after he got pretty well situated, left home, I, she sent for me. I came to live with them. They were in Baltimore then. I went to public school there in Covington. Good school, too. Mm-hmm. I never had any difficulty. We were in a rather peculiar situation. There was a white family, very wealthy man, who lived not too far from us, and he had some boys, and he had several farms, and he had a hardware store, and so forth. And he would let he made his boys come and play with us. He said, we had a very interesting thing I'll never forget in Atlanta, in Covington, when a Negro had been charged with raping a white woman, and she claimed that he was in the bushes when she came down the road, and he pulled her in. And they put this fellow in jail, and the mob came up to the jail to get him. So the sheriff walked out on the front steps of the house and said, "Boys, here are the keys. Said, if you want to come in, you can come on by this." And they walked away. Then I came to Baltimore to live with. I went to public schools in Baltimore. I graduated from high school, and then I went to Hampton, Virginia, to school. And I worked at the Printer's Trade the first year I was there. As a matter of fact, I had done a lot of work with the printing office in Covington. And every other guy in Baltimore, I used to get up in the morning and go down about 15 blocks and make a fire in the printing office and go back, go to school, and then come back in the afternoon and work there. But anyway, I went to Hampton. And,
What were you apprenticed to in Hampton? What were your plans to? What trade?
Well, I simply took the, as I said before, the apprentice trade. I had no particular plan. I had a very good friend. He and I hobnobbed together quite a lot. His father was a lawyer over in Portsmouth, Virginia. That's a town near Norfolk. And he talked to me about he was planning to go to Howard Law School, and he persuaded me to go. I never forget the first Christmas morning I was at Hampton. I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning and I heard the Christmas carols being sung by a group of students. I thought it was the most beautiful music I still do that I've ever heard in my life. To wake up at Christmas morning, hear the song "Go Tell It on the Mountain" and those Christmas carols. And later on, I sang on the choir at Hampton, and I had an opportunity to do the same thing. We always wound up at the home of a very wealthy man who was cashier of the First National Bank at Hampton. That's a white man, a beautiful home. His wife always provided donuts and coffee and apples for us. We got through. Then I had an opportunity to travel with him and with the Hampton Chorus. They sent them through the New England to kind of a public relations deal. We went to New York, and I don't forget the first time we sang at Harvard University, and we sang at Yale University, and we sang at Carnegie Hall, and we sang at Horticulture Hall in Philadelphia. I forget the halls in Maine where we sang, but we usually spent about a month in spring.
Mostly for white audiences?
Yeah, that's all it were.
Was the Hampton Choir similar to the Fisk
Jubilee? Yes. Yeah. By the way, when I was at Hampton Indians, they had about 150 Indians. They had a building called the Wigwam. The government provided everything for them, books, clothing, transportation, everything. And one of them was on the football team, and one of them, her name was Binda. Her husband was a great baseball player, her brother made. And she had a very beautiful voice, you see. And then summertime, I went to New York City, and as I said before, on the Hudson River Day Line. And we carried a quartet with us, and
Manager gave us $100 for the season, and we sang during the time the orchestra wasn't playing. People used to throw us money, you know. And we put that money in the fortune. We'd never take it out until I went to back school. We usually had $700 or $800 in the fortune. So we made enough money to go to school with. And then I graduated from Hampton.
What year was all this?
Well, let's see, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Because I continued to go when I went to Howard in Washington.
Do you recall who the director of the Hampton Choir was?
No, I don't. Nathaniel Dett was finally there when I last year I was there, but they had a white teacher who was for a while, and then there was a man there for a while. He was interesting enough. His brother was a chaplain. He graduated from Princeton University, and he wanted a job for his brother, so he brought him down. He wasn't much of a director, but anyway, we got along well. And then Dr. Morton, who was that time what they call the commandant of the cadets, he later became president of Tuskegee. He directed the singing and chapel services also.
How big was the choir? How many people in
there? About 40 people in the regular choir, but usually about 25 on all these trips.
And were you singing tenor or what?
No, I sang first tenor.
Did any of the people become nationally prominent who were in that group?
No, that's not right. Interesting enough, the this man who was appointed as secretary of transportation, his father and I were classmates. We went down to Hampton in 1962, our 50th anniversary. And he told me about his son, and I told him about my son.
What was the father's name?
I don't remember his first name. Of course, his name Coleman was the name.
And you both had known a lot of people who have become important or who've been written about or and become famous. Who else was at Hampton or Howard at the time that you were? We've talked about Kelly Miller.
Oh, yeah, well, of course, the man who started the Negro history, Dr. Carter, Carter Woodson, I knew him. There's a man named Clayman George who went to Cleveland and became very prominent there.
Is that Donald George's father?
Yeah. When I graduated from Hampton, I went out to Montana later the year. A really interesting how I happened to go. Senator Borel from Idaho was a very able man. He was known as the Lion of Idaho, a very able lawyer. And we had him speak in a fraternity meeting we had, and I was back in a public meeting. We had a visit with him before the meeting, and he complained that all the Negro lawyers bunched up in New York and Washington. Said, "Why don't you fellas get out the western part of the country and mingle with the people out there?" I said, "You'll do better," which is true. And anyway, the Shriners were meeting in Seattle, and they were advertising in some of the college papers for waiters to work on the railroads out there during the time that the Shriners Convention was going on. So I went to, first went to Buffalo. I didn't like Buffalo. The guy offered me a job, and I said no. So I went on to Chicago, and I didn't like Chicago. So I went up to St. Paul, Minnesota. And I went in to see the superintendent of the they owned the dining car and Pullman service. They had a great holiday. He said, "You, the red fellow I want." He said, "He sent me up to the doctor for an examination. I came back. He said, how'd you like to go out to Montana tonight?" I said, "Sure." So I went out to Great Falls, Montana, and we went down to Kalispell, Montana, and picked up the Texas train, which was a whole train of Texas trainers. And we went on out to Seattle, and then we came back to the Canadian Pacific and picked up another. Well, in those days, Montana was one of the very few states that was wet. And the guys who worked out on the road, some had been out there 40 years, 30 years. So they were just a bonanza for making money as a waiter, because so many sheep herders and hustlers and so forth traveled the railroads. So I had some books and I was reading all that. So they called me Doc. So they said, "Doc, we'd like to have you come back out here." Well, that's just what I wanted. So when I did it all the way back from Seattle to St. Paul, when we didn't see the superintendent, I said, "Well," he said, "what are you planning to do?" I said, "I don't know." He said, "Boys want you to come out to Great Falls." Well, that's just what I wanted. So I went out there and worked a year. I made a lot of money out there too. And this, in August 1960, I went down to the superintendent. I went down to Salt Lake City to see my brother. He'd been down there since 1960. I hadn't seen him. And he said, "I'll give you a pass to go." He said, "How long are you going to be going?" I said, "About 2 weeks." He says, "I'm going to give you a pass for a month, but I want you to come back." So I went down there, and I did stay a month, and I came back, and September I told him I was leaving. Oh, he was sick. Rather interesting how I am to come here. In those days, you know, they had the 24th and 25th Infantry, the 9th and 10th Cavalry. At one time, the 25th was stationed at, out in Montana, on the station. And one of the soldiers was a man by the name of George Woodson, who later got out of the army and went to Howard University Law School and came back out to Iowa and settled in Buxton. At that time, of course, I didn't know that, but Buxton was a town of 5,000 people. It was a mining camp, a coal mining camp. So I came there and went down to see him, and he took me around, took me to Albion, over to Oskaloosa. Luckily, I've been able to meet the general of the bar examiners. But anyway, I came here in October, so I had to wait until June to take the bar examination, which I did, and I passed. I took the examination the 3rd, 4th, and 5th of June and went out to the camp on the 13th. I was working in a, actually had 15 grand, and the guy who owned the building had been to Plattsburgh, New York. That's where the first reserve officer training camp was held. In fact, all the guys who went there were Ivy League boys, wealthy guys. They weren't in there for Negroes. And A. Philip Randolph, a number of prominent Negroes, challenged the president, and Newton D. Baker, who was secretary of the army, that the Negroes were going to march on Washington if they didn't do something about providing the same facilities for Negroes. So they asked them to hold up a little bit and see what they can do. So they finally decided that they would have them on and pick them on. Well, that's one of the things that I ran out to the register this week about this school situation. And I said, the Army just selected Des Moines as a community where people can know how to get along together, to put more than 1,000 Negroes in no trouble, whatever rules about it. And then they went back and put more than 1,000 women, because Des Moines was a good community then. And gosh, we don't want to spoil it with a lot of people who were.
You were living in Des Moines at the time you went into the Army. Mm-hmm. How did you sign up?
I went out to the for Des Moines, made an application, as Jim said, took his examination. and preliminary physical examination. Of course, after we went out there, then they really did take you through the examination.
Did you think then that Des Moines was selected, I guess they could put the camp any place, maybe partly because it was central in America, but mostly because it was a place where
people got along. And those weren't particularly happy days. Gosh, we had a riot in Houston, Texas, soon after, and to put over 1,000 Negroes in one move into a town, gosh, what are the white people going to think about this? But it was a beautiful situation. They were called on to appear in Mayor St. Dowd at Drake University, where they had assemblies in the field house, and where we were called candidates. That's what they made them called. They paraded for them at the Decoration Day. They paraded for them downtown. And just,
was the site of the camp street known as Army Post Road then, or did it get was it named after?
What
do you recall? What it?
I don't remember.
Did you two know each other?
No.
Never met.
Oh yes.
No. If I may.
Yes.
We knew each other after we were commissioned. But I didn't know him out of camp at Fort Des Moines. I didn't know him there.
What was you came to the camp? What was the life? What was a new camp? It was newly constructed.
No.
Use the old facilities.
Yes, sir. The 13th Cavalry was stationed there, and then we took over, and they moved in soon after we moved in. It was an old army post that was designed primarily to fight Indians in the Midwest, and so the Cavalry was on its way out then, and so they just...
Did you feel that the facilities were good, or that you'd just been kind of given second class? Camp.
Well, as far as we knew, the army, at least one thing they do, keep your facilities clean, and that's one thing they did out there. I don't think that we had any trouble out at the camp. And as far as some people have trouble anywhere they go, but by and large, there wasn't any trouble, and I don't believe at the camp.
Well, maybe I if you're
at least something
again. Things were not all good here in the morning, you can say that. Because General Ballou, used to eat out here on Mulberry Street, so when we were in town. And General Ballou used to go there and they had nice steaks. And he came in, he found out that they were discriminating against us, because we went in one time and they gave General Ballou a big, nice, wide steak like that, and gave us a little old crisp piece of steak like that. So General Ballou, he was colonel then, issued an order that if he heard of anyone discriminated against his cadets, that I'll put the town under martial law. So, as soon as that, I think the next day, they called him down to the motor club down here. And they gave him a brainwashing down there. And he came back the next day and assembled us all out on the parade ground and reversed himself. And told us that if you want to be good and recognized, you've got to make yourself so good and desirable that people would seek you, and you don't have that kind of talk.
You know what I was talking about, that we had no trouble at the camp itself. I agree with what you said.
Well, we did have some trouble that day. You remember that there was one fellow from Boston, Massachusetts, they called him a tree man. You remember that? Well, I do. They called him a tree man. He was standing right behind one of the company commanders. And I guess he didn't see this cadet, and he said, how are you and your tree men getting along? Well, this guy was kind of hot-headed, and he started to fight down there because they shipped him on out real fast. But as a whole, as J.B. said, we had no trouble out there. In town here, why they would even run into a little stuff once in a while.
Were there any size of a black community here at that time in Des Moines living here?
No, when I came here, I think there were about 3,000 Negroes living in Des Moines.
Yeah, that's pretty close.
You had to come into town to collect your checks from
camp? They paid us in gold. I mean, in gold coin. And man, this town was rolling in gold money.
How much were you paid a month?
$75. $75 in gold coin. I recall once that I came down and I walked into the, was it the Prince's Theater up there on 8th Street?
Yeah.
I walked in. I didn't know. I want to see a show. And I just walked in alone, sat down on the main floor. And so finally, the usher came down to me and said, these seats are not for colored people. I said, I didn't ask for a colored man's seat when I came in here. I said, I paid a fare. I'm clean. I'm decent and well-behaved. And I have money to pay my way. And I said, don't want to be disturbed. I want to see the show. He said, well, you have to move. I said, well, I'm not going to move. Fine, I had to call him in. I said, send him on down. That's the guy I want to see. So the manager came down. He sat down by my side a long time before he said anything. Pardon me, sir, but these seats are not, we are not in the habit, that's what he said. We are not in the habit of having colored people sitting in seats. I said, your habits don't worry me a bit, mister. I said, now, I have come in here to enjoy a show. I paid my way and I'm well behaved. I said, now, when I'm on the way out of you, and I said, I can have this place closed up. Well, I could at the time because General Balloon was behind us. But he walked away, didn't bother me anymore. But little things like that. People, you know, you get into a community. You see, that's one of the things that makes integration absolutely necessary. Because if you regard me from a distance and you never get a chance to rub shoulders with me, you take this terror stereotype thing you read about in the newspaper and you believe that. But now if we rub shoulders and talk as we are now, you say, well, I think that guy could put that. And that's just the way I look at the whole situation. Integration is religion with me.
Really, the soldiers came back to Des Moines to live after the war. By the way, Mr. Mitchell and I went to France together in the same regiment.
Yeah.
But as I said before, a good many came back to Des Moines to live and helped to infuse some new blood in the community. And as he said, that the princess, when Marian Anderson came to Des Moines the first time, she stayed at the Port Des Moines Hotel, and they asked her to manage to have a take the meals in the room. And they were permitted to stay at the hotel room and they're trying to not eat there. It was NACP, by having some of these folks arrested, that wrote up this discrimination. One particular drugstore we had here, and some of the taverns we had arrested, and they got tired of it. And it stopped. Can't have a lawyer to come up here from Kansas City and said, we have arrested every day somebody doing that. But you fellows are put real quick. They said, well, you're not looking for anything, you just be treated like anybody else. So this, it was a wholesome influence and it's helped. We've had the civil rights law ever since then. Well, the Code of 1898 had the civil rights law in it, but it wasn't enforced.
Did the state, you're talking about the state of Iowa law?
The state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of the officers who trained you at the camp were white? Were there any black
officers? You won't answer that gentleman.
Go ahead.
Well, we had all the commission, all of the officers in command, company commanders were white, but we had regular army sergeants and sergeant majors and corporals and stuff from the regular army to come here and do the actual training.
And they were black.
They were black, yeah.
They call it a cadre from each one of the regiments. From both the 24th and 25th infantry.
How long was your training?
Now that's a story.
Well, we started in June. I was supposed to wound up in the end of September. But the Army hadn't decided what to do with the soldiers until they extended the camp another month. Not all of June, but I think middle of June, July, August, September, and October. And then they would commission those that were passed, about half of them they commissioned. Lord Jim, I noticed that what's called, the chief spoke about 1,200, but I remember there were more than that.
There were 1,286 cadets that were sworn in out of Camp Nazi. I happen to know that. And then, too, I would like to say this. We had the troubles with Senator Bottomman of Mississippi.
Tillman.
He was Mississippi, too, wasn't he?
Tillman.
Hope Smith of Georgia. And Cold Breeze of South Carolina. They fought us teeth and toenail. They say that a Negro cannot lead his soldiers in battle. And they stopped the camp after the expiration of about 3 months. They called us a 3 month, the 90-day wonders, that's what they called us. And so we were all packed. We weren't going to stay with us, we were going home. And there were two young captains, white captains, recently finished West Point. They went to each company and said, "You got horses." It's amongst the several things they said to us. "You got forces in Washington fighting against you. They want you disgraced. They want you disqualified. Get that note." He said, "But I'm going to ask you to show your manhood and stay and defeat them. Don't let them defeat you." And we put our bags down and stayed. Is that true in your company, Jim?
Yeah. We had a finish enough to Captain Balcom, as Jim said, he had just graduated from college in Virginia. But he was actually, he was a soldier.
You remember his name?
No, M-O-N-L-E. He made a major, but in the camp of
mm-hmm.
He was an excellent soldier.
But you know, this one thing that I carry no bitterness in my heart, because we were living in a trying time. The one thing that has given me such a degree of satisfaction is the Negro, the black man, has always had somebody to fight his battle. And then the people that came to our rescue to fight, and you just might as well give them credit for it, because they did. That's why we, Colvin and Hope Smith and Tillman and Bottomman, those people were fighting against us. Smith had 1,000 fighting parts.
Jim, how much time you got in your car?
Well, I put 15 cents in that bag.
She did already. Then after this business of trying to close the camp, your determination to stay, then how long were you commissioned after that?
30 days.
Another 30 days.
Yeah,
this is 1917?
1917.
In what, November or October?
First
of November. First of November. All right, so at this point, where you two come to know each other? Yeah.
No.
Well, they gave us a leave of absence to go home and visit some friends and all that. They were assigned in camps all over the country. For instance, Jim and I were assigned in Camp Dodge, actually, the 366th Infantry, one of the regiments of the United States Marine. The artillery regiment. The corps come in and out of that. The corps come in and out of Camp Princeton, Kansas. And there's another regiment of infantry in Illinois, William, Ohio, one in Maryland.
What was your division?
92nd.
366th Infantry. 92nd.
And how did you take to your first duties and your first command? How did they go?
Well, it happened that I was the only, I was assigned to the machine gun company of the 266 infantry. And I was the only officer present with the company to receive 250 men from Alabama, and 90% of them couldn't even be fully literate. They couldn't even sign the table. And I had to receive these men, and I took them down to the barracks, and I looked around like half my men were gone. And I started looking them up around. I said, "Why did you come over here?" He said, "Well, my friend's over here." I said, you don't go with your friend." I said, "You do what you're told to do with this man's army." And I got to the road with him, and I heard him all back. And then we had to start to teaching the men how to just write their names. They had to do something. We sent a train load of men up here from Alabama. And the hand had a man that was 69 years old. They had got down to the station, and they were short one man, so they just heard him on there to fill up that quarter.
You know, like Jim says, 95% of the men in that 367 division were 3,600 men in the regiment. Came from Alabama. And in fact, all of them came from right around Birmingham. A lot of little towns around Birmingham. Birmingham is quite an industrial town. And a lot of coal mining. I see steel coming out of the plant there. And so many of them came there. And as Jim said, we discharged for mental or physical disability, and we got rid of about half of those men and kept bringing them to the end. And when we finally got them together, we had a doggone good regiment. And I tell you, it was strange.
How long did you stay at Camp Dodge?
Well, we went out in November, and we stayed down until May of 1918.
And you left with this group of men that you trained?
Yeah.
Or did you go in?
We went to, well, we, of course we went to Camp Upton for a few days, and then we took the boat at Hoboken, New Jersey, and went to France. Jim, we went to, what even down southern France, where you?
No, I went to Brest.
Oh, did you? That's right. Mm-hmm. Well, that's where I learned at Brest, and that's where on my way back to Brest. You know, rather really interesting thing, when we came back, you know, in February in France, that time of year, it's awful. It isn't cold, but it rains, and it's very, very disagreeable. And we were out at the Fontenay Barracks. That's where Napoleon spent his solitary days. And we were in the tent. The boys were camped in the tent. And before they knew what was going on, the new guy broke out, and 8 men died before they knew what was going on. So then they hopped in and had everybody, all the enlisted men had to be inoculated, even the officers were. I'm going to take any shot you got.
Well, they stationed us in my company inside the barracks. So no barracks was built. I think it said it was built by Siegel, wasn't it? Fontenay Barracks, just on our circuit, Brest. And while I was there, I explored around there, and they had some signs of military parts. They showed where they used to shoot men down, you know, before the firing squad, and the bullet holes were still in the wall where the bullets went through.
How long were you overseas then?
Until January 1918, I think, close to February. You came back on, did you come back on St. Louis,
Aquitania?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We came back from Aquitania. That was the largest ship afloat at the time. It was one of the old Cunard line ships. And there were 10,000 soldiers on board, 1,000 casual officers, and about 400 first class passengers, civilian passengers. And among them was J.P. Morgan on board.
Yeah. Okay.
And British exchequer, Lord Reading, the British exchequer, was on board. And what is this woman, Greg Palmer, born, was on board. And Billy Mitchell, who was later tried for his giving the honor of the devil out to Air Force, and then finally came around and he was commanding officer of the ship. I got a copy of the order he issued when we landed at Brest. I always kept it, and I wanted it. I don't know where it is. I said, no, I'm going to wait to see what they're going to do about what the moon.
What does it say?
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe we should read it exactly.
I'm getting back to General Mitchell. I ate his table a lot when I was going aboard the ship, that in the main salon, aboard the ship. And he called me his namesake. And Ethan and I brought it in, had conversation with Ethan Morgan. And he sat there, we sat on the promenade deck out there and talked for a long time, asked me his experience, stuff like that, and invited me to come to see him if I ever came to New York, which I never did too.
We have a tremendous band that you see today.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I never forget that. Going all the way back to the top of the town all the morning. We were what they call the loud. All the toes you got can go through Trinidadian process and then give you all the toes. And then we paraded out there before General Pershing. And I don't even think the first time I ever heard this song was
anything like real time when the human going on.
John Phillips, too.
Right, Sergeant Strike.
Sergeant Strike. Oh, I tell you, those guys, every time I hear that song, I guess the viewers.
I heard him play it on the air that day. And the band was the moving of their letters when the world was ordered to. But the band was taken on a high, big town on a high hill. And that band carried over miles and miles of territory. You could hear them at that thing. So at 11 o'clock, we were close to Good Friday. And that's the time we lost three of some of our best men. Some of them after 11 o'clock and said, it's difficult to get the message you like.
I was open message.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, which was addressed to the headquarters at 366 Infantry at Camp Upton, LINC, 3rd of March, 1919. To all organizations, the following order was published by the commanding general, H.M. Aquinaut, upon our arrival in New York on February 28, 1919. This order will be read to all companies at roll call after its arrival. General Order Number 6. In relinquishing command of HMP Aquinaut during her passage from Liverpool to New York, February 19 to the 28th, I take this opportunity to express my satisfaction of the kind of health and discipline of the voyage, and my appreciation of the high sense of duty and soldierly qualities displayed at all times by both officers and men of this command. William Mitchell, Brigadier General, USA. Mm-hmm. How many men did you lose in your company?
I don't know, exactly, but we lost some very close friends.
You know, I never forget this.
As soon as the November 11th, at day, the gentleman came over in American
Mind. I wish people back home. I said, well, what we will do? You'll be back in 10 years. I said, we miss you once, we'll miss you twice. And he was just as nice as he could be. You know, there were places in the front line trenches there that one particular, those mountains.
the Germans would come down to this nice little pool down there in no man's land, and the French would go over and they'd go in front of each other.
They didn't have long.
Yeah.
You know, the Germans had trenches where they had many men, electricity, running water, everything else.
You know, that's one thing I have never been able to understand about the German people. The most enlightened people in the world would allow a knucklehead like Hitler to take charge of the government. I just can't understand that, how they do it. They were just complacent with him until he made a fool of himself. Don't you think that's true?
Good lesson there somewhere.
Of course,
if you know somebody else trying the same thing, you know, they hide inside it. Did not try it.
Well, that's true. Odin tried it, I suppose.
Did you have an opportunity to visit any other places while you were?
I didn't, unless you were stationed close by. You could. Now, I didn't even get to Paris. I just got on the outskirts of Paris. And then I was at the Joan of Arc's birthplace, Dorigny. I was in that place, and people, the French people worship that place now because she was an angel, or really an angel. She led the forces of victory, you know, when they were being defeated.
You know, I was a children's officer, I'm an Italian, and whenever we got into Louisville, I went ahead for a week, and to find a looking place for the guy in Spain, you know, the state of Bond, and he just had to find a place to fall. So I got to travel around, but I think that the nicest place I went to was Nancy. And you know, Nancy had one of the most beautiful cathedrals in France. And I tell you that thing, that you look like a big little old tournament on it. I never saw such a short trick like that in my life. Oh, that's what the French people were most of the way to the
cabin. I was in Nancy, and when we got up into the front line, this is when we were starting to drive on Metz, wasn't it?
Yeah, on the Moselle, down the last one down the Moselle River area. You know, the Mets.
Yeah, I think you crossed that at the end because we were moving towards the final drive of Dargon.
Yeah, but you couldn't get to Nancy after the St. Neil Drive because the Germans had a devastated
in
the American army, and they could.
I think you got your geography a little mixed up. Because I remember we were in Nancy, and I was in Nancy 2 days after the armistice was passed. And when we moved into this sector over there, when we were starting to drive on Metz.
Okay, this is side two of a conversation with Mr. James Mitchell and Mr. James Morris
well,
and Mrs. Alina.
Well, this town, Nancy, was pretty much shot up, but there was still a lot of business there, and you could go there. Well, and going into the front lines, we lost a lot of dropouts along the way who couldn't see. When we went in the army, and they'd give you a coordination, so-and-so, that says might be 50 miles from here. They tell you, you will report to coordination of whatever the case may be. And then you get there the best way you can, mostly walking. They didn't have any lorries or anything to transport troops in those days. And I was sent back to Nancy to pick up some stragglers. So they had two famous cafes there, the Café Le Deux Hemisphères, the Café Lorraine. And so I went in the Café Le Deux Hemisphères. There were African soldiers, there were just American soldiers and French soldiers, and just all of the Allies were just mingled together in there, drinking and having fun. And I walked in and there. The little girl who ushered me in, she noticed there was a table over there with three American officers, and so she thought I'd be welcome there. So she ushered me over there, and so I started to sit down, and one guy turned and started looking out the window. So the other three fellas, you know, just received me with open arms. They happened that they were from Minnesota and Wisconsin. This other guy was from Louisiana. And so I said, just many gentlemen, I said, I appreciate your welcome, but I said, I don't want to break up your party here. I said, I'll find a seat. And he said, no, you don't. You're going to sit right here. So I sat down. And pretty soon this fellow turned around and he looked at me and he stood up. He said, gentlemen, I've been a fool. He says, and to you I want to apologize. I said, shoot, well, I had a little champagne then. And so he says, you know, I was born and raised in Louisiana. And he says, and they taught me down there that Negroes weren't any better than dogs. He says, and I got to believe that. He says, I find that they are better than dogs. And he says, brother, I shake your hand and greet me. And you know, I corresponded with that fellow a long while, you know. He says, I'm a school teacher back in Louisiana if I get back. And says, I'll teach the kids in my class that Negroes are better than dogs. Well, that was quite an experience, you know, because I think he was convinced.
Hmm. You know, Thanksgiving Day 1918, that was just a few days after the armistice, we were assembled in a town called Pont-Mousson. And they had a building there that looked just like the auditorium. Mm-hmm. And they said that Pont-Mousson had been shelled more than any town in France.
There wasn't a whole building standing.
There was a building in the town that didn't have a hole in it. This building
That's
said,
right.
And I never forget, General Ballou had been relieved of the commander of the regiment, and a guy by the name of Martin, by the way, he was from North Carolina, was put in charge of the regiment. And at the meeting, he spoke, and I... he certainly did raise my regard for some of the guys who, even though they came from the South, felt that a guy needed to be a man. And he said, says, men, says, you've acquitted yourself in France like men. And he says, well, I want you to go back to America. I want you to stand up and be men. Say, you're soldiers of the United States Army. And I want you to be that way. It's just like when we first got off the train and loaded dressed, we had trouble with some men that died with raping some of the French women. We were supposed to stay there 2 weeks to give you a chance to kind of get yourself together. We were on the boat for 13 days they took the gold on. And so they moved us over to Bourbon the Bain, that was the headquarters, the division headquarters, that's down in the Vosges Mountains.
Yeah, I know.
And we got on the train, and the commanding officer gave word that nobody should get off the train en route to. And the guy who was, of course, the officer of all together, battalion commander was an old army sergeant, white fellow, by the name of Salkin. I'll never forget him. He was from Arkansas, but he was a heck of a guy, and he said to his God damn it, says, I don't mind the commanding officer to tell my officer to not get off the train. He says, every time you guys want to get off the train, you get off. And if the major wants to raise hell about it, let him come to me about it. But we were, the guys were pretty mad about it. When we got down, on the 4th of July, we got down to our training area. And General Barnum, Marvin Hill Barnum, who was the brigade commander, came over and called the officers together and made a speech to them and told them that he realized that some of the things we were up against, but he says, I want you to stand up and I want you to be men. And says, you can always count on me to be with you. And that really gave the guys a real boost, you know.
But, when you mentioned Malvin Hill Bonham, General Bonham, he was what you might call a personal friend of mine. He called me by name every time he saw me, and we were repulsing an attack in the Vosges Mountains once the Germans were coming up the valley, and I turned four Vickers machine guns on them and swept them back, and so
soon after that, I'm out in the trenches, you know, trying to see what I could. And I felt a hand on my shoulder. And I looked around, and there was General Bonham. He was one of the few generals who ventured to go into the front line.
That's right. And he says, "Hi, Mr. Mitchell. I didn't know that this was." I said, "Is this you, General?" He said, "Yes, this is I." I said, "How are you getting along up here?" I says, "Well, it's kind of rough sometimes, but we take care of ourselves." I said, "That's the spirit. That's the spirit." And he slapped his leg and went out. He had his staff with him, you know, and his horses outside there. And he was in a dangerous spot, but he didn't know it.
I
didn't think.
I tell you, funny experience I had as a children's officer. We've always had to brief the guys when they had to go out on patrol, because we had the maps and everything, we knew the lay of the land and so forth. And over in the support position of the regiment, we kept noticing big 155 millimeter shells being pumped over the general's line, and then boom. And the little building, the guy that was in the little clump of woods, said, wasn't as big as this house. So we went over there to see what they were doing, see them, you know. And they were there, and there were three Senegalese, great big black French soldiers and three white fellows. They all jumped up and, you know, they were very, so we go blocking out together. And we began to talk some of our poor French, and one of the guys says, "Lieutenant, talk English. I used to live up 135th.
Okay. Yeah, I had a bad experience with some Italians. Oh, God.
Did you have any experiences or with the Senegalese soldiers? Did you get to know any of them at all?
I did. I saw a Senegalese captain commanding a white French company, and they respected him just like, you know, so different to what you would see in America until it just disturbed me a little. And they were big, tall fellows, blue-faced. I ran into one, and in my feeble way to speak French, he was Senegalese. And I said, "Hello, fella." Tribal marks burned in his face, you know, had one earring on. And he had a very heavy voice. He looked at me up. I said, "You're a Negro, aren't you?" "Yep." I said, "Well, I am too." He looked at me and says, "Oh, I know. But you know who." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because your ancestors were slaves." Mm-hmm. Can you imagine that? You see, the American Negro today is the most enlightened Negro in the world, but he's most hated and despised. Despised by, I don't think it's that way now, but the Africans didn't have any use for American Negroes.
You know, the Senegalese came from Senegal, and before the Americans went into the war, France was being bled pretty badly, and they needed help. And there was one Negro in the Senate, I forget his name now, Clemenceau persuaded him that if he would go down and convince the Senegals of the attitude of the French, that he would use his office and everything to see that it was carried out, he could get so many of these soldiers, and he did, and you know, the Germans were afraid of them because of the great knives. Boy, they captured, they just take you, just cut your head off, you know. And the Germans were really afraid of them. They don't want to be bothered, you know.
Well, they were the ones that saved France at Verdun, you know. 600,000 of them saved France at Verdun. And I was standing on the banks of the Meuse River with a bunch of American officers and French officers. And so one of the Americans said to the French officers, "How many Negroes do you have in your army?" "Not any, sir." "So we all just simple Frenchmen." Just like that.
getting back to this town of Nancy, I was in Nancy 3 days after the armistice, and I was a sight I could never describe to you. I saw women were walking the street with a champagne bottle in each hand, stark naked, just crying and just carrying on. They were so happy that the Americans had saved it. What did you do? I saw that in Nancy, brother.
Were either of you married?
Yes, I married before I went over.
How did you communicate or correspond?
With well, they had the AEF, what they call an American Expeditionary Force. You could write to the expedition, and then they'd look you up at headquarters and forward your mail to you. You'd be late getting it sometime.
I did by the will of it during that.
Yeah, that's right.
And had either of you studied French before you went over, or you learned it?
They had us do a little smattering of it before. But you know what's surprising? I don't know how well you can learn the French language if you are thrown into where you've got to use it. And there's so many words, if you just listen carefully, that things get spelled exactly the same, but pronunciation is different. You can get along very well.
But I heard you called up the Romance of Languages, did you? Of course.
Yeah.
You made them actual.
How did, were you treated well by the French people?
Oh gosh, I tell you, it's just indescribable. I didn't think that could happen to a black person. They take you in their homes and they just do anything. Now, I was town major whenever my company went into a town. In other words, that meant that I was the American mayor of this town, and I lived in the mayor's home. And one day after the war was all over, little town of Hadange. Were you ever there, Jim? Small town. And I lived in the mayor's home. And so they were sending the band around to these different towns where the American soldiers were stationed, to send the band around to entertain and keep them busy and keep them thinking about something, not getting in trouble. And so I looked over my shoulder and I saw Mr. Houdin there, and I spouted him. He says, "When you have finished here," says, "please come to my office. I'd like to talk to you." I said, "Well, we go now." And so I called Holter's Army, walked around to his office, and he took a pamphlet, a little brochure, and showed it to me, handed it to me. And this is the gist of it: that we white Americans do not appreciate the fact that you are accepting Negroes as social equals. And he went on to tell about how inferior we were and all of this sort of thing. And Mr. Houdin, when I handed it back to him, he said, "How do you account for this?" I said, "Prejudice." He says, "No, it isn't prejudice." He says, "Just jealousy here." And one other thing he said, I don't remember at the time. Jealousy and fear. And says, "You know, it's, you don't just hate somebody because you want to hate something, not human beings." He said, "Now I take it in America that a commissioned officer is a representative of his government." I said, "Yeah, that's true." He said, "Well, the man that brought this brochure to me was your same rank." And I say, "If you be his inferior, then that's a reflection on the government, isn't it?" You think? Wonder what they think? Those French people, they wouldn't stand for that kind of stuff.
Now, I've read the reprints of that kind of thing, which was circulated by some of the white officers and white American officials over there. Did you have any other difficulties with the white army people in France compared to fraternization with local people?
Yes, we had, but we just brushed it aside. I was sent back, and when we went into the Vosges Mountain, I was being sent back to Saint-Dié to pick up some stragglers from the front line back to the town of Saint-Dié. And when I got back a little way, I saw a sign up where there was the YMCA. They were serving some coffee and donuts and cocoa and stuff like that. Well, I
went down under the ground, thought I could stand some of that, and the two women like that, they wouldn't pay me any attention. Finally, two white officers came in from our headquarters company. And they, you know, how the language they use, what in the hell are you doing? I said, I'm on a mission for the colonel. He said, sat down. As soon as they sat down, they rushed over to serve him. I said, what's the matter, Mitch? Aren't you going to have some? I said, I guess not. I said, I've been sitting here for 15, 20 minutes, and they don't pay me any attention. Shoot, man, those guys raised particular hell. Oh, man, I never heard a man talk to a woman like he did. And he says, I'm going to report this. And say, you might as well pack your trunks because you are going back to America. And it happened. They did. They were junior officers just like I was. But that kind of stuff was common. Now, I was walking down the streets in San Diego, and you remember the Wildcat Division that had moved in there from South Carolina? And I said to myself, now, I come over here to fight the Germans, not to fight the Americans. And so, as I walked down the street, I met one of these old, tall, lanky boys from South Carolina, and he stopped and looked at me. He said, what is this? He didn't salute anything. So, I got mad. And I had passed him. Then I turned around. I always had a pretty strong voice, and I hollered at him, and he straightened up. I said, get to attention. And I had my hand resting on my sidearm. I says, come here. Pick up the double tie. He walked over to me. I says, what army do you belong to? You belong to the American Army? Yeah. I said, what? Yes, sir. I said, did they teach you in that outfit to salute officers when you meet them? They told me that we didn't have to salute niggas. I said, well, you don't. I said, but as long as I wear this uniform, you better salute it because you're in big trouble. So I took my coat and had hung it on the iron picket fence, and I made him salute it with the cadence for 10 minutes. And the thing about it is, I looked across the street, and that was a great big old boy, by golly, with an MT on his arm. I said, MT, and he straightened up, and I said, over here. He walked over. I asked him who his commanding officer was. He told me. I was on my way then to get ready to move in to start in the Marbash sector. And like I said, I told him, I said, now there's my card. I said, give it to your commanding officer, and you may tell him that if I'm not back within 3 days, I said, he can turn this man loose and send him to his outfit. I said, so. And I told him, he had the whole story. And he grabbed his boy and kicked him in the nose and said, come on, buddy. Well, I didn't care for that part of it, but that just showed you how things went with the guys from down south, you know. But
I just wanted to cite how that thing was carried on. When they built the Veterans Hospital out here, they didn't even take Negro soldiers out there for treatment.
That's right.
What year was that built?
I don't know. Oh, it's 30 years usually. And the American Legion, we have several posts here, but I was a charter member of the American Legion. Matter of fact, I was in France when the American Legion was being talked about and being formed. And interestingly enough, the Negro officers had a meeting to decide whether they thought they ought to organize a separate Negro veterans organization or to go along with the American Legion. They voted to go with the American Legion. I know that from a national standpoint, from too many years, the American Legion was pretty rotten. But this state, the American Legion, has just been wonderful as far as Negroes are concerned. And they joined in with us. Go out and challenge this commander outside the hospital. He said, well, I don't believe it because white people being in the same hospital. So we told him that
Well, we're going to try to get rid of it. He said, well, that's your privilege. And my guy said, it wasn't too long before that guy was gone. Well, the next guy who came here was just the opposite. And in later years, the director of the hospital was a Negro. So we made a, and they, the American Legion has all the things that the Negro widows have tried to do. They just, it makes me mad sometimes to the criticism of the level of Johnson. But the Veterans Administration sent representatives into the Negro neighborhoods to seek out Negro veterans to explain the benefits of them and urge them to come down. And so there just haven't been any complaints. Now, fact, I have an instance where the American Legion, by the way, the county commander of the American Legion in this county is a Negro. They were the commander of the 1st District, which comprises a number of eastern counties, what the first called the 1st District is a Negro. And one time there was out in Potawatomi County, that's where the next to Omaha, there were Council Bluff. There was a Negro county commander there, so they had just. Fine. I tell you rather, this happened before the war. But we, I was in the base hospital, and was in a separate, barrack, not the same building, but all the Negroes were also listening in there. So we'd been eating around in the dining room, that's where we had the strike. So one night, the commanding officer sent word for all the Negro officers to come into his office. And we went in there and he told us that he wanted the Negro officers all sit together. And he would only speak about why he thought it was the best thing and so forth. So I said to him, he finally said, asked us if we had anything to say. And I said, well, the Colonel, I said, we're all in this thing together, and it seems to me as though to do that is somebody that's just against what it's supposed to be fighting for. He said, well, shut up. Well, nothing to say to him, but we went along with him. So, next morning we went in the dining room and we all sat at the table. The white fellows came on there, what the hell you got all doing rushed over here together? The commanding officer said, well, you'll fix him, says, when you guys come in to lunch. And you wait till we all get in. We'll occupy every table in the dining room, at least one or two seats in. So, that's what we did. The old colonel came to the door and he looked and he smelled looking like a toad frog. You know, but he had nothing to say about it. It sort of simply shows that people can make things go right if they want to, but it doesn't take a lot of effort if you simply stand up and be decent about it.
I'm telling you frankly, I never thought I'd live to see this day. And I can stand up on my hind legs and walk and talk like a man.
Well, I think you always do that sometimes.
Well, you can do it now unmolested. I was talking to his son. He was in New Orleans not long ago. And when he got back, I said, Brad, I says, how did they treat you in New Orleans? He says, well, I stayed at the finest hotel in New Orleans. And says, enough, when you go down there, all you need is some money. You do anything that your money lets you do. Well, you see, I lived in the South and things were just the reverse.
Tell us about your coming back to Des Moines, why you came to Des Moines after you were discharged.
Well, I think I did tell him that, didn't he? Did I?
Why I came back to say?
Jim, you can finish it, but I'm going to have to go. I got an appointment.
Mm-hmm.
You can finish it with him because he knows everything that I know.
Yeah. Because I wanted to get into, there are several things that happened throughout his life that I think this reflects. Tell us about why you came to the morning.
Well, why I came to the training camp, or why
no,
I came,
why
to,
you came to Des Moines to live after your army.
Well, I think I told you about the time at Millersville when I had to draw my sidearms.
Mm-hmm.
And at this terminal station, I think I told him that.
Yeah. Now, what happened when you came to Des Moines to live? What did you do first?
Well,
you left the army. You resigned from the army?
No, I had been, well, of course, resigned is the proper word. At Camp Gordon, Georgia,
And so when I came to Des Moines, several things happened right here that made me feel that I was still in the South.
Well, tell us about you had lived here a while, I realized, before you started into business. But were you the first Negro pharmacy and drugstore in Des Moines?
Well, no. There was a man by the name of Wade McCree, a druggist, had his drugstore right there in Lovington and Center Street. And he closed his drugstore, and he went into the government service, narcotic division of the FBI. And so this building was up there, and 12th and Center Street, a nice new building, and bought it for a song and dance, and so we had to do something to make it.
What year was that?
That was about 1925, I imagine, somewhere along there. But Wade McCree had long preceded us.
And your wife, Azalea, went to pharmacy school?
She went to pharmacy school.
After you bought the store.
And I rolled up my sleeve and went to work and just dabbled into a whole lot of things, you know, trying to make this old age comfortable.
A bit about your bondsman business. Had there been other bondsmen?
There was one fellow who acted as a bondsman for a white company. And so when I went into it, why, that was something unthinkable, and they tried to disqualify me. Right there. We had a pretty mean lawyer here, Charlie Howard, you've heard of him. And he, between the two of us, why, we broke the barriers down. And he got so just accepted me as one of the boys.
I wanted to ask, before you, were there men in your outfit or that you knew about who didn't want to come home or who stayed in France?
They couldn't stay. They wouldn't discharge them. Of course, they decided they would let them stay in France. I applied for it. I wanted to stay in France. But they turned me down, just like they did all the rest of the fellows. They issued an order that if anybody wanted to be discharged in France, they could do so. And of course, I grabbed the situation. You know, you've heard of the Belleau Woods? Well, my machine gun outfit held the left flank of those Marines that attacked it in Belleau Woods. And you tell me that American soldier is no good. I'll never believe it. Because I'm right there and I saw what happened. Belleau Woods, I believe it was, they changed hands 6 or 7 times in one day. The Germans would drive the Marines out, the Marines would come back and strike and drive them out. And it ended up in the American hands. And that they lost an awful lot of men. I tell you, in that Belleau Woods looked like
right.
They shot down. There wasn't a standing tree in there when they got through with that heavy artillery.
Did and sometimes, you know, in 1919, after soldiers came home and after the war, and after being treated as human beings abroad, 1919 is sometimes called the Red Summer because there were a number of disturbances in different cities around the country.
That's true.
Was there any kind of discontentment, you know, where you were or people you talked to? Was there a resentment after coming back of the realization that that speech you heard that day you signed up was all nonsense?
Well, I tell you, I had some of it myself. My father was stationed, he was living in Millersville, and he was coming over to the town of Barnesville to preach at this church there. There's a visiting preacher. And I got that information from home, and so just Barnesville, I think about 30, 35 miles south of that matter. And I got on the train and went down there, thought I'd spend an hour or two with my dad, see. And so, when I got there, about 1 or 2 o'clock, this minister that told me that my father had spoke at the morning services and he had gone back to Millersville. Well, I missed him and I couldn't get a train back to Atlanta until 5 o'clock. Well, he said to me, he said, my people here have never seen a Negro officer.
Say, how would you come to like to come over to my afternoon services and let them see you? I said, and speak to him. I said, well, man, I'm no speech maker. I said, I'm just a little hard-headed soldier. So he said, well, I don't expect you to be a spellbinder, but just to see you. I said, okay, I'll do the best I could. He said, well, that's Bill Ziegler. I think he's practicing dentistry over here in Chicago now. He lived there, and he had just been discharged. He said, I called Bill Ziegler to come over and be with you. He's a fellow about your age, and he called him over. I told him what I was going to do. So I got up there, and I guess I talked about 35, 40 minutes or something like that. And so when I concluded, I made this statement, which was an error. I said, I talked mostly about what my experience in the Army. And I said, during my travels in the Army, I traveled 20 to maybe 25,000 miles. And I had the privilege of rubbing shoulders with men from every corner of the globe. I said, and the most damnable creature I met in all my travels is this southern white man. The preacher got out of the church, and he went on over to the parsonage. Nobody even did this to nobody, but everybody turned around, started mumbling, and you could hear it in there. And so I went back to my pew, and I said, Bill, I said, what's the matter with these people? He said, I'll tell you later. So we went outside. Nobody came near me. And so pretty soon, an old man bent over on a stick. He came over to me, and he said, son, he said, I know the stuff that you said, if that was true, but I think he was doing you whole journey. And maybe I am. So he said, and if I were you, he says, I'd leave town right away. I said, why do you say that? He said, because before you get out of this town, some of these Negroes are going up and tell the white folks what you said, and says, they'll do something about it. I said, well, I tell you, Dad, I said, I have faced life and death many times. And I said, no, I'm not afraid now. I said, my train leaves at 5 o'clock. I said, when my train leaves, I will be leaving. Well, it's getting pretty dark, you know, at 5 o'clock then. And I was standing down at the station, and I was resting there with my hand on my sidearm. And they mingled around, looked in my face, and this, that, and the other, and pretty soon the train came, and I went on back. On Wednesday morning, I got a letter from Bill Ziegler. He says the mobs found they found the mob, and they searched every Negro home in Bonsville looking for me. They wanted to hang me. And I tell you, I guess I was lucky to get out of there. So many little things happened, you know.
One other connection with Mr. Morris and World War One, the person from whom he bought the IOI signature, which he was editor and publisher for many years, wrote a history of the Des Moines encampment. You have that, Mr. Morris, to just tell us what you know about
John Thompson's
history.
Well, he was he came from Decatur County down here in Southern Iowa, and he went to Drake University. That's where he studied law. I don't know when he bought the bystander. And the bystander was started by a group of men who were a bunch of waiters and porters and so on around town who felt the need of a publication about the news about Negroes could be published. And also,
I'm going to look at that car again.
Opportunity for some young people maybe to be employed in that capacity. And then they went on, they sold to him. And then I bought it from him in 19. No, I didn't buy it from him. Lawrence Jones down at Pinewood School in Mississippi bought it. He wanted to use it as a training ground for some of his young students who had graduated down there who would take printing in his school. But they had no knowledge of managing the newspaper. They
didn't work out very well, so he sold it to me for practically nothing. Sorry, I bought it. But I did wind up selling it, and not too bad.
Had John Thompson written the history before he went out of the paper business?
Yeah, yeah. See, it was during the time that he was, that the camp was here, that he wrote this history. Because he sold a lot of the men bought copies of it. I had a copy once, I don't know what the devil came of. You know, Dr. Chase was going to get that Gagone, him, the one from the library. He was going to make some machine copies of it.
How long did you own the newspaper?
50 years.
50 years?
You know, at one time I, in my 40s and 50s, I ran this newspaper, and I bet you I remember during there times when one year when they had such a flu epidemic here, I tried it. I haven't done criminal cases in 1 week. Just because I didn't want to be able to try them. And I was quite active. I've seen the time I had a fellow working for me who was a drink part of it. I remember getting out of Tenebris edition, 12-page paper. I made it all up myself. Those days we used type, you know. Now it's done by offset process. But I learned, as a matter of fact, I think before I did a little dabbling in the printing business when I was a kid in Georgia, then when I went to Hampton, I did. And then during the time I was living in Baltimore, I worked for a printer there. Well, even while I was at Howard, I worked for a printer I've kind of had my hairs in ink for a good many years.
There's one other thing that we're hopping around your life. You were one of the founders and charter members of the Negro Bar Association.
Yeah, it's called the National Bar Association. You know, at one time they did have one called the Negro Bar Association. It was a part of the Negro Business League. And Mr. Whitson, who I told you about, motivated my coming to staying, Harvey. He was very much disgusted because they never did anything. They had it, of course, a reason because very few states had my Negroes were admitted to the county and state bar association yet. And they've always done it, I say always, certainly since I've been here. In the 1910, 15, all back there, those members of the bar association, they still are. And they've come a long way on the thing. You know, at the session of the association out of San Francisco in 1973, one of the great complaints was the number of Negroes were not passing bar examinations, even guys who were graduated from Harvard University and other schools. And they felt that a lot of it was traceable to cut down on the number of Negro lawyers in the country. And at that time, only one state had a Negro member of the bar examinations, and that was Connecticut. But this year, the bar examination they had this last time, they have members of the board, and they called in other people when they had the examination. And Brad, our son here, was one of the examiners this year, the bar examiners.
What year was the National Bar Association founded?
1926.
Well, do you recall who some of the other founding members were?
Well, let's see. There was S. Joe Brown, of course, was a lawyer here. Charles Howard. And George Woodson, he was the moving force in it. Then there were Joe fellows came from Chicago. I remember a fellow by the name of Green, who later became a judge, one of the early judges in Chicago. And, I think Earl Dickerson came. Earl Dickerson, wound up his prison in the Three Liberty Life Insurance Company. He was general counsel for them. But it's going to be quite
Crohn's and post. You know, any time a lawyer is considered for a federal appointment, the judge, attorney, some of those, they have to get to okay the American Bar Association. They check them out. And, they do that. They also, with Negroes, they give the National Bar Association that privilege of having a check with them on. Which helps some, because at least you can't come in and say that. But here's a rather interesting thing. The American Bar Association tried to get the National Bar Association to become a part of the American Bar Association. But the guys who were running it didn't want to move with us. I think the voters were bad. They, as the National Bar Association, they had the hands in the pockets of the Ford Foundation and the Rockefeller Foundation from time to time, but they couldn't do that. They had to be a part of the American Bar Association. I remember the first Negro that they had the controversy or admission to the American Bar Association. The name was William H. Lewis. He graduated from Harvard University, played center on the Harvard football team. And he wrote a book on center on the playing football. And Taft appointed him an assistant attorney general. There are a lot of what they call assistant to the attorney general, but assistant attorney general is different. They put you in higher. And he was a specialized in immigration law. And, he was appointed him assistant attorney general. And, of course, there was Morfield Storer, who was attorney for the American Bar, the Negro Bar, NAACP at the time, and who, of course, you know, was very, very active in the NAACP. They quite a plan to have Lewis admitted to them. And they finally compromised by admitting Lewis, and in the future that whenever an application was made to the membership of the American Bar Association, his photograph should have come there. Well, of course, that's out now. You know, they really solicited to membership now in the American Bar Association. So we need a lot of progress, a lot of directions.
You're the only living member at this point?
I'm the only living member of the original members and organizers of the National Bar Association.
Did you know a man in Howard at law school named Lee Whipper?
Lee who?
Whipper. I don't know. I don't know if he was there exactly the time you were. I just wondered.
I don't know. That name sounds familiar, but I don't know.
Very quickly, I noticed in the paper that here in Des Moines, they've asked for a stay of busing for 3 years or something. Yeah. What is your personal and professional opinion about the busing here in Des Moines?
I don't know what will ever happen to it, but I think what they will try to do is to make it as palatable as they possibly can, but they're going to have to come up with something on it for the reason that the federal government is behind this as a part of the means of affecting equal education opportunities. And I think that the school board, if they do wait for 3 years, maybe they can. Maybe they'll have to get moving. It isn't up to them. It's, a lot of these folks are raising all this devil, think you can vote it, but that's nothing to it. So I don't know what will come up. But I think that if we can keep people quiet and not raise hell and tear up the community, I think the thing can be worked out. Now, there are a lot of problems about busing that you have to recognize. And that is that, for instance, Negroes had to do it when they were in the South. They had to travel by white high schools and bus to a Negro school 10 miles away. Kids who lived in the neighborhood and the busing over to
another neighborhood has its disadvantage, but the thing that I think the big thing is this, that Negroes and white people have got to learn to live together and work together peacefully. I said to the youngsters, if you want to get a big job, whether it's in a profession or in a business, you're going to be working with white people. You ought to learn from early childhood how to get along with, how to deal with people. I think that's a great part of it. Our success in being able to have a good community is for people to get along with each other. And I think it's a very important thing. And I think that seems to me that transcends any other disadvantages that you might have to recognize as being possible. People can do what they want to do. Using myself as, I belong to the Episcopal Church here, the old church at one time, all the rich people belong to it. I want to thank my, I've been members of that for 3 years. And 6-7 years ago, they elected me a member of the vestry. That's like the deacon board of most churches, except they have this one. And gosh, one of the guys nominated me for secretary. I wasn't there. They elected me secretary. Clerk of the vestry, they call it. And secretary of the church. And some of the ladies that my wife was quite a dressmaker for years here, and I know one of them named Mrs. Raymond. She jumped up and came and said, J.B., I need you to make it. But, you have to get somebody who's willing to get out in front and help to push these things through. There are a lot of people who would join in if they had a leader in it. But nobody, it is needed to get somebody who's willing to get out in front and take the leadership. We had one of the Don Bunn's elections in this town, Yellow Saw. 1926, the Ku Klux Klan, right away after the First World War, the Ku Klux Klan really got strong in the North. Indiana was just flooded with it. And Albany got its share of it by long shot. They elected, without anybody knowing it, two members of the school board who were Ku Kluxes. And in 1928, they put up three more. They wanted to get control of the school board. Well, the businessmen downtown decided that they couldn't stand for that. And they organized a committee, they spent a lot of money, and they really put on a campaign, and they defeated it, and they had never had it. But they were pushed to it because they couldn't have the Ku Klux Klan running schools.
Was there ever a
ride
of the Ku Klux Klan in Des Moines?
Ride? Uh-huh. Oh, yes. Jimmy, you remember that? They had a big parade downtown, and here's the most peculiar thing about it. The guy who led that parade was a grocery up in Highland Park.
He was commissioner, safety commissioner.
And he was
Jennings was his name.
And he didn't know that he was one of the best friends that Negroes had in this town. And anybody in these old towns, they'll tell you that's John Jennings. And he was just that way. It's just peculiar. Now, of course, what happens is that the people in the North claim that they were shooting at their own Catholics and the foreigners. Well, I said to me, you go and talk to one of the Catholics and you tell them they shouldn't be niggers.
Well,
would you do a little bit of the development of the Center Street business area, because this is a dead era that we need to cover?
Well, there's a Negro, two of them by the name of Blackman and Sheldon. They got to a Jewish fellow here and made him spend about $150,000 putting up a building up there on the corner of 12th and Center Street. Well, McCree had at the time moved his drugstore to the east side at 16th and University. And so there just wasn't any business up there. Well, this building later went into litigation, and I bought the building for $6,000. Yeah, you know, that was a good firework.
What year was that?
That was around about, you mean when I bought the building? It was about 26 or 7, something like that. And there was just no business up there, and so as we got along all right, the other people were influenced to come in and start the business. We had pretty good little business center up there. And
your particular involvements were with the drugstore and with the Billiken
dance hall. There was a theater in there, and I turned that into a dance hall. And then I wasn't making as much money as I thought I'd like to make, so I went out and got into the bail bond business and started fooling around with the real estate. You know, just let somebody go to sleep, and then I'd buy it. Bought some some property up there on tax, delinquent tax, you know.
You booked big bands from out of town in the Billiken.
Oh, yes. Duke Ellington's been here, and Cap Calloway was here, and Count Basie was here, and Dewey Jordan had died, and just all of the big bands of the country came here and played for us. And all that put together, it made a pretty good little salary for me, and so I'm resting now.
you rented some of the other parts of your building. Name some of the places that were in those.
We had a hall downstairs, which I rented to the Elks. And then the upstairs right over that was a theater. So I revamped it and made a dance hall out of it.
Was that live theater or motion picture theater?
Motion picture. And then we had 5 storefronts in there to rent in this building. It was nearly a block long. And it was in litigation, so Scott Pigeon up here at the bank, he just made me buy it. So I said, okay, then. So he did. It was about $150,000 outfit, and like I said, bought it for $6,000 because the bank didn't want to fool with it.
Were any of the other businesses between 9th and Center and 12th and Center in business at that time, or did those all develop after you?
Well, at that time, they had a restaurant, a barbershop. At least they had 2 little eating places in there. And then they turned this.
And that started turning into a Negro business area?
Oh, yes.
Previously?
Yes, it was generally conceded that that was a Negro place of business. You see, one thing that's happened in this country is certain classes of white people would move out to the outskirts of town, and then that left the Negro down here in shadow of multi-million-dollar buildings and property. So they had to find some way to get rid of us. And so that's what it was. And so they just started this urban renewal thing.